Hi, this is Barry List at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. What drives innovation? What quashes it? In today's segment, we talk to Mary J. Benner, an assistant professor of management at the Wharton School. In a disturbing piece published earlier this year by the INFORMS journal Organization Science, Professor Benner makes a case that financial analysts have set back innovation in two important industries. The study is entitled Security Analysts and Incumbent Response to Radical Technological Change, Evidence from Digital Photography and Internet Telephony. Professor, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you.
To begin with, how did you become interested in this avenue of research, and why did you suspect that financial analysts weren't four square behind new innovative products?
Well, in general, my research has been focused on the topic of technological change and what makes it challenging for organizations. So that's kind of where I started with this. A lot of research that has been done in the past has been focused on, you know, issues inside of firms that make them inertial or sluggish in responding to new technologies, like culture or outdated managerial mindsets. And I started to be interested in, you know, how external factors, you know, external stakeholders might also play a role in how easy or difficult it is to respond to new technologies and innovate. And shareholders or investors and analysts are important external stakeholders, so I thought it was important to figure out what their role was. I guess I didn't know initially that they wouldn't be four square behind new innovative products. I was sort of interested in understanding what their reaction would be to firms as they tried to innovate under these conditions of major technological change. But there's some evidence out there that suggests that analysts and investors sometimes object when firms reach too far beyond their kind of core capabilities or their existing industries. So this idea that as you become too much of an unrelated diversifier, you could destroy value. So I had some sense that maybe these forays into radical innovation might be seen as too big a departure by shareholders and analysts.
So, what led you to the two industries that you decided to study?
So the two industries, the photography industry, which I was focused on the shift from film technology to digital, and then wireline telecommunications, basically the phone companies, and the increasing shift from sort of wireline technology to internet telephony, internet protocol technology. The two main reasons I picked these industries, one is they're nice examples of radical technological change, this big shift to a new technology in an industry that sometimes often actually results in technological substitution. These are big challenges for the firms in the industry. We've seen a lot of these examples historically, like, you know, the shift from steam locomotives to diesel electric technology, or quartz technology and watches, making mechanical watches obsolete, and so on. And the interesting thing about these industries is they were sort of undergoing the shift to the new technology as I'm studying them. And the second thing that makes them useful to study is that since I'm interested in understanding how securities analysts react in these settings, these are industries that have large publicly traded companies that are covered by securities analysts, so it made them sort of nice settings to take a look at this question in.
In the summary or abstract of your study, you note that managers routinely face pressures from financial markets to choose strategies that maximize shareholder value. Doesn't that mean developing cutting-edge new technologies?
So not always. Actually, not that often. It depends, I think, in part on what investors and analysts have come to expect from a particular firm. And if they are accustomed to, you know, if a firm has been valued as an income stock for a long time and they're accustomed to seeing this firm have stable, predictable cash flows and dividends, then shareholder value is likely to sort of be a continuation of that. You know, some cutting-edge innovations do pay off really well over the long term. But in general, innovation is really risky, costly in the short term. Sometimes the results aren't known for many years in the future. So I guess unless you're the sort of firm that analysts and investors expect to be doing cutting-edge innovation and kind of understand how to incorporate that into how you create shareholder value, in a lot of cases, that kind of innovation isn't going to directly be seen as maximizing shareholder value.
And I was wondering whether there's a certain short-sightedness taking place here, whether it's what Americans have been complaining about, that there's solely a focus on the next quarter's financial earnings or dividends.
So I think I come to, I mean, I've heard that complaint, you know, that there's been this short-termism that's going on and it has an effects on companies' earnings and investments. And, you know, I think I end up observing maybe a similar result, that it sort of appears that there's sort of a short-term focus. I think I'm studying something a little different, this sort of major shift in technology that's very difficult to value, to sort of understand what's going on, and so in the process, you know, it might tend to make analysts or investors, you know, more comfortable with things that are predictable, sort of ongoing cash flow and things that you can measure more easily. So I guess it's, you know, probably a similar result, but a slightly different cause with these sort of major technological changes.
We'll go on to discuss examples from the two industries in a moment, but first let's review a couple of your findings. You say that analysts are more attentive to companies extending old technologies, film in the case of photography, and wireless technology over the internet, phones and telecommunications, than they are to companies trying to compete head-on with emerging technologies. Can you explain what's going on?
So I'll talk a little bit about the data. The data I collected in the study showed, you know, exactly what you said, that analysts paid much more attention to the, for example, in photography, to the new film-based products that firms were introducing than to digital cameras. And this was, the evidence is just, you know, the number of times an analyst talked about these different kinds of products and the technologies that underlay them. So, for example, basically in the year before Polaroid went bankrupt in 2001, analysts spent many pages talking about these new instant film cameras that Polaroid was introducing, and not very much at all in talking about the threat of digital substitution or digital products. So those are the findings from the study. So the question of whether I can explain what's going on, you know, that's a little bit more of a challenge. I should mention, you know, these results were very surprising and puzzling.
They sound that way.
Yeah. Well, because, you know that at some point these firms face, you know, disastrous longer-term performance consequences if they don't figure out how to address these technologies. So I'm not exactly certain of exactly how this unfolded, but I am certain that this is what I saw in the results. And, you know, I speculate a little bit that, you know, it may be that analysts and other observers and researchers are worried that these firms won't be successful in the new technology. And, you know, that's an important consideration. I don't think that's a good reason to ignore it entirely and not discuss the issues at all surrounding it, which is really what I saw in these results.
You also write that at turning points in the recommendations about buying a company's securities, analysts were still more enthusiastic about products that extended old technologies or created hybrids tied to the old technology. And when you say turning point, do you mean the point when a product like the digital camera is starting to gain wide acceptance?
Well, so actually in the study, I think the main turning points I was referring to was the turning points in analyst recommendations from, for example, a hold to a buy or from a hold to a sell. And I used those opportunities, those specific turning points and recommendations, to try to understand what's their justification, what is it that they're saying as they do this. And this was, you know, more kind of evidence for the idea that they really were very favorable about the products based on the old technology. So there are these frequent upgrades in ratings during the period, especially for Kodak, even as digital technology is really diffusing and replacing film. The analysts are upgrading based on film sales, you know, saying film sales and film market share are strong, and so we're going to upgrade to a buy. And so I think those are the issues that I was looking at. But it is clear that at that time, digital camera sales were, you know, taking off. People were buying digital cameras at the time. We could kind of see the writing on the wall as users of digital cameras at the time. So it's a little surprising that the kind of long-term prognostication about stock price would be positive at that point.
So let's drill down into the case of photography. In the 1990s, both Kodak and Polaroid saw that their competitors were developing digital cameras. They were aware of this. They tried to develop their own products, and what happens with the financial analysts?
Well, so Kodak and Polaroid do develop digital camera products. In fact, Kodak was one of the first providers of digital cameras, introduced its first digital camera in 1991, was one of the, you know, inventors, basically, of digital technology. And I study how analysts sort of viewed these products, both the tone of their reaction when they discussed these and then how many times they were mentioned compared to these other film-based products. I found in a few cases that it seemed that analysts were actually directly negative about these new technology products. So there's one example of an analyst referring to Kodak's investments as money squandered on digital nonsense. But a predominant result is that the analyst just really rarely mentioned either the sort of underlying technological shift to digital cameras that was going on, or Kodak or Polaroid's entry into this market. And Kodak, at this point, between 91 and 2001, introduces 45 digital cameras, so is clearly, you know, participating in this market. This is surprising because, you know, engaging in this market for Kodak and Polaroid clearly affects their financial performance in different ways, and it also probably affects the diffusion and success of digital photography overall when these major incumbents are actually, you know, producing digital cameras. But there's very little discussion of it in his reports, and particularly compared to the attention that the analyst paid to instant film products or other film-based products at the time.
I was wondering about the media. I would think that people like Walter Mossberg in the Wall Street Journal and people who follow the tech industry and the media were covering these cameras quite a bit. Isn't that so?
Yes, exactly. I mean, there were lots of articles around this time, even, you know, in the Wall Street Journal and Business Week, talking of, you know, speculating about digital technology and when it would actually replace film technology. And many of us had a digital camera, but, you know, I had a Kodak. I'm not that much of an early adopter. I had a Kodak digital camera in 1996, and it didn't have wonderful resolution, but I think even then, you know, we could see that digital technology was going to be superior to film at some point. These firms were announcing their camera introductions, so information on this was readily available.
So at what point did the analysts start changing their point of view?
So this study that we're talking about went to about 2001, and it's right at the end of that study period in photography that the securities analysts start talking more about digital cameras, particularly in the case of Kodak. So they start tracking product introductions and commenting on market shares and things like that, which is, you know, this 10 years after, so a full decade after Kodak has entered the industry. And there's also a point sort of in the late 90s where they start to engage in a few more discussions about what Kodak is doing in digital, and they become more positive about Kodak's efforts, though even at that point they're not really discussing sort of particular products or market shares or things like that. But there is kind of a notable shift in their attention to this. However, at the same time, when they do upgrade their sort of stock recommendations on Kodak, the justifications appear to still largely be about film sales. You know, we're positive because film sales are up, et cetera, et cetera.
Let's turn now to telecommunications. I recently compared the cost of my landline and that of a VoIP or voice over internet phone. And after an initial investment of about $250, I found that my annual cost for the internet phone would be about $12.50 compared to over $700 to continue using my landline. Didn't financial analysts anticipate consumers like me running these numbers and dumping their landlines?
Well, you would think that's what they would be thinking about. I mean, and there's a lot of background in thinking about how technology substitution happens, and it happens as the new technology starts to perform a lot better and it becomes much cheaper, so you get a better price-performance trade-off. So that's what I would think. I mean, I'm talking on a voice over IP phone right now. And,
and it's a very clear line.
It's working quite well, yeah. So, you know, many of us could begin to anticipate this around, you know, even earlier than now, like around the time that Skype entered, you know, basically with free voice over IP services in 2003 and Vonage was in 2002. So even, you know, back then you could start thinking, gee, I think, you know, maybe voice over internet telephony is going to at some point dominate this kind of landline, wireline technology. But at that time in my research, analysts were not talking about it in their reports on these on the wireline telecom firms. And, you know, despite the fact that these companies obviously saw that there was a challenge there and had started to develop their own voice over IP-based services in order to respond, the analysts were still very, very silent about it.
So what happened?
So similar to the findings in photography, you know, early on in this setting, as voice over IP is diffusing and developing better, the analysts rarely talk about this. They spend a much more time talking about and being excited about the incumbents' efforts to get into long distance. So long distance services were wireline technology, and they really see long distance as kind of the next big thing, despite the fact that voice over IP is clearly diffusing, lots of people are adopting it, and we can kind of see the writing on the wall. So very similar to the results in the photography setting, a real interest and focus on sort of the old technology, extending the old technology products and services, and kind of silence about the new technology.
You show some compassion, if that's the right word, for analysts when you write that they may act the way they do because they have trouble determining, setting the value of new technologies. Can you explain?
I'm not sure I was being compassionate, but I'm trying, you know, there has to be some explanation about why this happens, and it's very surprising. So, so I speculate, you know, technological change is very challenging, for managers in particular, as we've documented in the past, you know, but also for analysts trying to value companies under these conditions. So the challenge of a new technology is that it's very difficult to predict both the technological form that it's going to take. So there's competing product designs. The technology itself is in flux. We don't know exactly at what point the technology is going to perform well. And then there's the market uncertainty. We don't know exactly when consumers will adopt it. We don't know who the winners will be or what features will be important, and we don't necessarily know what the profit model will be. So there's all these factors that are in flux in a major technological change. And, you know, I speculate that they might wait, analysts might wait to kind of figure out how this is going to unfold a little bit more before they begin to try to put numbers to it in their forecasts. So that's my potential explanation for why they're silent about it for such a long time.
We only have time for a couple more questions. You write in the final section of your paper, the strategies required for adaptation and survival in the face of technological obsolescence may be at odds with the strategies associated with value construction by analysts and investors. Where does that leave managers at today's companies?
Well, so it means that managers who are faced with these major technological changes, there are two kinds of challenges. Not only the considerable challenge of changing your strategies and developing, you know, brand new capabilities and knowledge to be able to compete successfully in this, you know, brand new landscape, but there's also external pressures from, you know, your important stakeholders that might actually work in the opposite direction. You know, it may be, and I think some of my study findings suggest this, that analysts and investors might not want companies to change if it means, you know, changing sort of the predictable earnings and cash flows that they're accustomed to and entering into a very uncertain new domain of new technology. So I see, as an example, I see some evidence of these pressures in my research. I came across a great quote from Ivan Seidenberg, who is the CEO of Verizon, during a meeting with analysts where he's talking about Verizon's investments to compete, and he says to the analysts, we can't be afraid of you or afraid of the market in reaching for growth opportunities. So it's clear to me that CEOs really feel these pressures as they're trying to respond to these important technological changes. So I think it's important for managers who are facing these things and want their companies to survive and create future value to understand that the pressures from the market and analysts might not be accounting for the new technology, might not be rewarding them for their efforts in the new technology. In fact, might be rewarding them for sticking to their knitting, for cutting investments, maximizing short-term cash flow, and actually kind of not responding to the technology. So I think managers need to be aware that the challenge is considerable and these pressures might be inconsistent in these circumstances.
You have some advice for managers navigating these tricky waters of radical technological change. What is it?
Yeah, so, technological change creates both opportunities and challenges. And many companies have been successful at, doing what's necessary and creating, future value in the face of these kinds of changes. So it may be that analysts and other observers are sort of trying to wait until the uncertainty is resolved. Managers might not have that luxury. They have to make some critical strategic decisions early on as the technology is unfolding. But it's important for managers facing situations to realize they need to manage on both fronts, both the technical pressures, responding to the new technology, and then at the same time, possibly being in a position to educate the analysts and investors about the sources of long-term value, why these technological changes are challenging and why they're doing what they're doing in order to respond to the new technology.
And finally, in his book, Free Fall, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz makes a point that during the financial crisis recently, banks failed to fulfill their most fundamental responsibility, which is to underwrite things like plants and factories that help companies grow the economy. Do you think that these financial analysts fail America's business in the same way?
So that's a great question. I'm not sure if I'm in a position to say anything quite so bold directly from the results of my research. But I can stress a couple of things that do come out of my research. So in the past, a lot of times, we sort of blame firms and their managers for being kind of unaware or slow or sluggish to respond to major technological changes. And I think my research shows they're not alone. They might get a lot of support in their sluggishness through the reactions of, their investors and their analysts and, these external stakeholders in general. I think my findings do show that, in general, analysts, which are reflections of public equity markets, might tend to favor firms that have predictable earnings and cash flows. And these tendencies could persist even in the face of big changes that really fundamentally change the business that these companies are in. So, there's the potential for these stakeholders to exacerbate these organizational tendencies to stick to the knitting. I guess I'll leave it to others to figure out if this is a failure or not. There's a bigger question here, which is that some people question whether America's firms should be responsive to these types of changes or whether they should sort of maximize cash flow as they go out of business and be replaced by new firms. So I'll leave it to others to answer that question.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Mary J. Benner of the Wharton School. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.